Welcome to the deep dive.
Right.
Right now, a thief doesn't actually need your password to ruin you.
Right.
They don't need your fingerprint. They don't need your two-factor authentication code. None of it.
Yeah.
To hijack your entire digital life,
mm-hmm.
they just need to quietly photocopy a digital cookie while you're asleep.
Yeah, and they can walk right past the heaviest security on the internet.
Exactly. So today, we're pulling back the curtain on this truly massive investigative dossier. It's the Tech & Night September 8, 2026 technical briefing. And our mission for this deep dive is to explore the underlying architecture of digital trust and ownership.
Which is incredibly timely, honestly.
Right. We're looking at how your digital identity is actively being stolen, how automated financial systems are just hallucinating and losing millions, and why the gaming industry is fighting so fiercely to protect tangible ownership.
It's all connected.
It really is. And before we get into the weeds here, I highly recommend you visit takinggame.com to read the exclusive print and archive edition of this briefing for yourself. It is sharp, it's authoritative, and honestly, it's just completely necessary reading if you want to understand where the internet is heading.
I mean, it really is a remarkable piece of journalism. It brings together, you know, confidential production pipelines, high court legal rulings, and some genuinely terrifying zero-day exploits.
Yeah, terrifying is the right word.
And to understand this whole concept of digital ownership, we have to start at the baseline of digital trust, right? Our personal accounts. Because the foundation we've all been relying on is currently being invisibly undermined.
Right. So the first file in this dossier focuses on a malware strain called JSEAL. And it possesses hitting Chromium-based browsers. So like Chrome, Brave, Edge, and also Firefox.
Yep.
And the headline here is that it bypasses Google's two-factor authentication entirely. No passwords stolen. So how does a hacker bypass 2FA without actually bypassing it?
Well, by exploiting our own demand for convenience, really. The
no.
methodology is a weaponized implementation of a pass-the-cookie session hijacking.
Pass the cookie, right.
Think about your daily web use. When you log into your Google ecosystem, the back-end identity provider doesn't want to force you to type your password and check your phone every single time you switch from Gmail to Google Docs.
Right? Oh, that would be infuriating. I'd lose my mind.
Exactly. So it issues these time-limited, cryptographically signed session tokens.
Right. It drops these little files into the browser's local circle like cookie jar, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the system just remembers who you are.
Yeah, exactly. It's a stateful design. But JSEAL infiltrates your machine usually through something innocuous, like a fake browser extension or a Trojanized archive download.
Something you click on without thinking.
Right. And then it runs an in-memory scan. It leverages the Windows Data Protection API, the DPAPI master keys.
Okay, wait. What does the DPAPI do exactly?
So Windows uses DPAPI to encrypt your local credentials, assuming that if you're logged into the Windows user profile, you know, you're the authorized user.
Ah, I see.
The malware uses that assumed trust to decrypt your local credential stores, extracts those live session tokens, and then just shoots them over an encrypted tunnel to the attacker's server.
Okay, let's unpack this. So if standard 2FA is this massive, impenetrable titanium vault door.
Right.
JSEAL is just a thief who silently pickpockets the vault manager's master key card while they're sleeping.
Yes.
So the vault door doesn't even matter because the system looks at the key card and just assumes the thief is the manager.
That is the perfect way to visualize it. Because once they have those cookies, the attackers don't just log in normally. Mm. They replicate your active session inside an automated headless browser.
Headless meaning no screen.
Right. A web browser running without a graphical user interface. It's strictly through a command line interface. And to Google's identity verification servers, the incoming traffic looks completely legitimate.
Because the initial password was already verified hours ago.
Exactly. The biometrics are checked. The hardware 2FA was cleared. The attacker now has unrestricted administrative access to your corporate emails, your cloud storage, your password vaults.
All without triggering a single suspicious login alert on your phone.
Not at all.
And if you're listening to this right now thinking, well, you know, I don't keep crypto passwords in my Gmail, so I'm fine.
Yeah.
The briefing notes that JSEAL also has this automated clipboard manipulation module, a clipper.
Yeah. And this is where it gets financially devastating.
Truly.
The clipper continuously monitors your operating system's clipboard buffer for specific cryptographic wallet string patterns. So if you copy a Bitcoin, Ethereum, Solana, or Tion address to send funds,
JSEAL just swaps that address out in milliseconds for the attacker's vanity address.
Yep.
Wait, so literally in the split second between hitting CTRLC and CTRLV.
Exactly. By the time you hit paste and click send, your outbound transfer is siphoned off to a completely unrecoverable destination.
That is deeply unsettling. I mean, if the thief already has the master key card and standard authenticator apps offer zero protection against this, how does the cybersecurity industry actually defend against it?
So security engineers are pushing really hard for the adoption of Google's emerging device-bound session credentials, or DBSC.
Not there. Explain how DBSC fundamentally changes the math for the attacker.
Sure. So it cryptographically binds your active session cookies to the local trusted platform module, specifically the TPM 2.0 hardware chip that is physically soldered onto your motherboard.
Yeah.
It uses asymmetric public-private key pairs. So even if the JSSeal malware extracts the raw cookie string from your memory and sends it to the attacker, it's useless.
Because they don't have the hardware.
Right. The cryptographic proof required to validate that cookie cannot be duplicated without physical access to your literal physical silicon chip.
Okay, binding it to the physical hardware makes total sense for my personal laptop.
Mm.
But what about at an enterprise level? Like if a network engineer's device is physically compromised or their token is hijacked in a way that somehow fools the TPM, the attacker just has the run of the entire corporate network, right?
Which is exactly why security operations centers are moving beyond just checking credentials and adopting continuous adaptive trust, or SACAT models.
SACAT models.
Yeah. You can no longer assume a valid cookie. Even a hardware-bound one means benign intent. Next-generation security continuously evaluates telemetry signals in the background.
Like what kind of signals?
It looks at browser canvas fingerprints, the specific characteristics of the TLS handshake securing the connection, and even microbehavioral mouse kinetics.
Wait, mouse kinetics? You mean the security system is tracking exactly how my hand moves the mouse?
Yes, because human movement is erratic and unique. Automated scripts moving through a headless browser, they just don't mimic human jitter accurately. So if the telemetry detects that the mouse is moving with the, you know, mathematical precision of a script, the system instantly broadcasts a cryptographic revocation signal. It invalidates the session and kicks the user out before the attacker can move laterally across the network.
I mean, if we have reached a point where we have to analyze the micro twitches of a user's mouse just to trust a basic login, it makes you wonder why we just blindly hand over millions of dollars to automated algorithms.
It really does.
Which connects perfectly to the Kalshi prediction marketing glitch that's outlined in the dossier.
Right. It's a stark contrast. We have this hyper-paranoid browser security on one hand and then just catastrophic vulnerabilities of algorithmic trust on the other.
Right.
So Kalshi is a federally regulated event contract exchange. People bet on real-world outcomes. And recently, they suffered a multi-million-dollar data oracle failure during a highly anticipated nationally broadcast college football game.
The dossier calls it an ingestion desynchronization. Break down what actually failed here. Like, how did an algorithm hallucinate a football score?
Well, Kalshi relies on external sports telemetry providers' data oracles to tell its smart contracts who actually won a game. These oracles communicate using JSON payloads, which are basically just lightweight text files containing the data.
Okay, pretty standard.
Yeah, but in this instance, there was a sync error. The external API sent a corrupt payload that falsely recorded the losing team as the winner.
Oh, no.
And Kalshi's core smart settlement engine, it didn't watch the game right. It just read the text file. And because the platform's architecture prizes instant liquidity and immediate gratification, the smart settlement cleared instantly.
Meaning it distributed millions of dollars to the losing bettors, who, of course, immediately withdrew the funds via wire transfers, ACH, and stablecoins.
Exactly. They vanished.
So what does this all mean? I have to push back on the architecture here. Why on earth are we building high-stakes financial futures on systems that lack the basic common sense to double-check a result before wiring millions of dollars off-platform?
That is the exact question financial risk consultants are screaming right now. The core vulnerability is that centralized exchanges prioritize speed over asynchronous safety.
Speed over safety.
Always. When settlement logic executes atomically, meaning the second it receives that single JSON payload, the transaction is final, Any corrupt packet or race condition turns instantly into irreversible fiat transfers.
And once that money hits a third-party bank across different jurisdictions.
Right. Clawing it back is a legal nightmare. It's gone.
But how do you fix it without destroying the, you know, the automated nature of the platform?
Centralized fintech is actually starting to look at decentralized prediction protocols for the answer. Decentralized platforms often use bonded optimistic oracles.
What does that actually mean in practice?
It means the settlement isn't instant. There is a mandatory multi-hour challenge period. The capital pool just doesn't unlock immediately. There is a window where the community can contest the outcome if the data feed hallucinates.
Oh, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, so financial consultants are now urging market operators like Kalshi to implement automated circuit breakers. For any settlement event over a specific threshold, say $1 million, the system enforces a mandatory 5-minute hold.
Just 5 minutes.
Just 5 minutes to allow automated sanity checks and cross-source telemetry verification before the clearinghouse credits user wallets.
A 5-minute breathing room to ensure the algorithm isn't handing out millions based on a typo.
Right.
Now, it's one thing when algorithms fail by accident. It's a completely different threat model when the failure is deliberately engineered by the trusted humans running the servers.
Yes.
Let's talk about the RuneScape rogue admin.
This is a landmark case out of the Cambridge Crown Court in the UK. A former senior systems developer at the British studio JGEX was sentenced to 44 months in prison.
Wow.
Over an 18-month period, this developer stole billions of old-school RuneScape gold pieces, rare party hats, and legendary armaments.
We're talking about billions of virtual gold coins. How does an employee even pull that off without triggering massive internal alarms?
By abusing the ultimate level of trust. The rogue engineer exploited their elevated administrative privileges to suppress the internal audit trails. They essentially turned off the security cameras while they worked.
That is wild.
They compromised high net worth player accounts, disarmed the multi-factor authentication locks from the inside, and just funneled the virtual wealth into illicit holding accounts.
And they didn't just hoard this gold to show off in the game. They liquidated these stolen virtual assets on black markets through real world trading. They walked away with over 650,000 British pounds. That's upwards of 850,000 U.S. dollars paid out in Bitcoin and privacy coins like Monero.
A massive payout.
Yeah. Here's where it gets really interesting, though. The dossier mentions a national cybercrime unit caught them using graph clustering algorithms. For the listener who isn't, you know, a forensic accountant, how exactly does graph clustering catch a virtual thief?
So to move that much crypto, you leave a trail. The cybercrime unit looked at UTXO consolidation transactions, unspent transaction output. Think of it like a thief breaking into 1,000 different piggy banks and stealing handfuls of change. Eventually, they want to buy a house, right? So they have to take all those scattered coins and consolidate them into large bills at a bank.
Okay, I track.
Graph clustering algorithms map out the complex web of all those small wallets converging into a few major off-ramp accounts. Investigators correlated the timestamps of when those crypto wallets consolidated with the exact timestamps of when the developer accessed the game's internal database.
Oh, wow. So the algorithm basically acted like a digital UV light, exposing the developer's invisible fingerprints across the blockchain, layering it over their employee time cards.
Exactly. And the math proved it was the same person.
But beyond the digital detective work, the legal precedent here is massive, isn't it?
It's monumental. The defense naturally tried to argue that virtual items lack tangible legal status. You know, you can't steal a sword that doesn't exist.
Right, it's just code.
But the UK judiciary firmly categorized in-game digital goods as actionable property under the Computer Misuse Act 1990 and the Fraud Act 2006.
Which means?
The message is clear. Virtual insider crimes carry tangible, life-altering, real-world criminal penalties. The courts now recognize virtual wealth as legally protected wealth.
Which is huge.
Yeah.
And when you look at how fragile virtual wealth is easily stolen by rogue admins or lost in Kalshi's automated glitches or completely compromised by JSEL malware,
right.
It completely recontextualizes the next part of this dossier. It perfectly explains why gamers are fighting so fiercely to protect the ultimate form of ownership, which is physical media.
Yes.
Which brings us to the recent panic regarding Sony PlayStation.
Right. The supply chain logistics rumors, there are these sensational headlines claiming Sony Interactive Entertainment was preparing to slash physical PlayStation disc production by 90% by 2028.
People were freaking out.
Consumers panicked, assuming this all digital console monoculture was just being forced upon them.
But the Taken Knight dossier sets the record straight here. Sony debunked this entirely. It is not a 90% extinction. It is a measured 10% production adjustment across global optical disc pressing facilities by 2028, which is just, you know, standard operational alignment with organic digital adoption curves.
And honestly, if you look at the financial disclosures, physical media is far too lucrative to abandon. Physical Ultra HD Blu-ray discs still generate between 35% and 40% of first-party day-one revenue for premium blockbuster releases.
40%.
Yeah, that is a massive pillar of their economy, particularly in continental Europe, Japan, and the Middle East.
I have to ask, though, if digital downloads are so incredibly convenient, right? You click a button, the game installs while you sleep. Why are physical discs still holding on to nearly 40% of blockbuster revenue?
Well, it comes down to marketing visibility and data logistics. First, premium retail end caps.
Like in stores.
Right. Imagine walking into a massive electronics retailer like MediaMarkt in Germany or Fanit in France. Those physical cardboard displays in rows of pristine plastic cases, they offer irreplaceable marketing impressions. An algorithmic digital storefront, which is tailored to what you already like, just cannot replicate the raw discovery of walking past a massive physical display.
That makes total sense for marketing, but what about the user experience? Why does the player want the disc?
That's Kranis, the data logistics piece. In developing territories or even just rural areas in developed nations, residential internet connections face strict data caps or heavily throttled speeds. A massive AAA game can be 100 gigabytes or more.
Oh. Trying to download that on rural Wi-Fi would take a week.
Exactly. Optical UHD Blu-ray discs are the most efficient method for delivering that massive install footprint without completely saturating a household's bandwidth. But most importantly, and bringing it back to our theme, physical media acts as a safeguard against digital store closures or licensing revocations.
You actually own it.
You can trade it, lend it, resell it. It represents sovereign consumer ownership.
And the studios know this, which means they still have to engineer these massive 100 gigabyte blockbusters to run flawlessly off local hardware. Case in point from the dossier. Insomniac's standalone Venom project, codenamed Project Lethal Protector.
Yes. There had been these persistent rumors that following Insomniac's fierce cyber attack in late 2023 and the tragic passing of legendary voice actor Tony Todd, the Venom spinoff had been quietly shelved or just chopped up into minor DLC for Spider-Man 2.
Right, but the investigative sources in this briefing confirm that is completely false. The standalone Venom game remains in robust, active, and fully funded production.
Which is great news.
Yeah, it's slated for late 2027, bridging the narrative gap to Spider-Man 3. It's designed as this tightly paced 10 to 12 hour AAA campaign, similar in scale to the Miles Morales game. And importantly, they are honoring Tony Todd's legacy with a dedicated opening in-game tribute while recasting for the upcoming chapters under really close Marvel supervision.
It's the right way to handle it.
It really is. But from a technical perspective, making a game about Venom requires a completely different approach than a guy in a spandex suit, right?
Mm.
I was reading about this dual-layer simulation system.
Oh, absolutely. Insomniac's core tech division in North Carolina basically had to rethink character movement from the ground up. Traditionally, video game characters use rigid bone hierarchies. So imagine an action figure with defined hinges at the elbows and knees.
Sure.
But Venom is this viscous, shifting alien symbiote.
Right. You can't just put a fluid alien onto a rigid stick figure skeleton. It would look ridiculous.
Precisely. So they implemented an advanced nonlinear skeletal mesh deformation pipeline.
That is a mouthful.
It is. But essentially, Venom's character model uses that dual layer simulation system you mentioned. It combines a foundational biomechanical skeleton with a continuous volume preserving dynamic fluid mesh. Think of it like a water balloon dynamically wrapping and shifting around a muscular core.
That sounds computationally exhausting for the console's processor. What does that actually look like for the player holding the controller?
Well, it allows the symbiote's tendrils to procedurally wrap around dynamic environmental geometry. So Venom can latch onto fleeing adversaries and morph his limbs into bladed weapons in real time.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. The engine has to calculate the fluid displacement of the alien biomass instantly. The architectural triumph here is that they are doing all of this without triggering visual clipping artifacts, all while maintaining the studio's strict 60 frames per second performance target. They are simulating the raw muscular tension of the alien organism dynamically.
Getting a processor to simulate the micro-level fluid dynamics of an alien symbiote at 60 frames per second without stuttering is just wild.
It's a huge leap.
But, you know, developers aren't just pushing processing power to simulate muscle tissue. They are pushing it to simulate the macro level sweep of human history, which takes us to our final stop in the dossier. the massive Civilization the Seventh reveal at PAX West 2026.
Right. Firaxis Games laid out a multi-year post-launch roadmap that just completely electrified the grand strategy community. It is a dual-pronged approach. First, there's a free Ark of Tomorrow update arriving in winter 2026, which re-engineers Atomic Age diplomacy and non-proliferation treaties.
Okay.
But the real crowd pleaser is the return of Mahatma Gandhi.
Yes, and they kept the franchise folklore alive. He Zan's an ardent pacifist who loves peaceful trade, but if you cross his sovereign borders, his AI flips into an uncompromising retaliatory nuclear deterrence doctrine.
It's such a brilliant nod to the game's history.
It really is.
But the real technical leap comes with the paid expansion, Civilization the Seventh, Earthrise, launching in spring 2027. This expansion pushes the game beyond the atmosphere by introducing a dedicated orbital layer map.
Like space stations.
Yeah. You're managing lunar mining outposts, geostationary research telescopes, orbital solar platforms, all culminating in an interstellar colony emergence victory condition.
Okay, this is where I need you to explain the logistics because I am highly skeptical here.
Mm.
Wait, they added an entire orbital map layer that the game has to calculate on top of the terrestrial map, but they're promising seamless multiplayer crossplay between expansion owners and base game players.
Yes.
How does the engine not immediately buckle and crash under that kind of synchronized load? Like, if my friend doesn't own the orbital map, how are our games even communicating?
It requires a fundamental rewrite of how the game thinks. To support this computational overhead, Firaxis engineers completely overhauled the simulation core. It is now written in, that's a synchronous bottleneck. In the new C++23 engine, the game uses asynchronous job scheduling. The engine decouples the deterministic turn logic, which is the math of what the AI is doing, from the graphical draw calls, which is what you actually see on screen.
Ah, so instead of one master chef doing it all sequentially, you have 24 sous chefs prepping ingredients simultaneously, while the master chef just focuses on plating the final dish.
Exactly. Artificial intelligence decision trees for up to 24 rival leaders execute asynchronously across idle CPU cores. The AI isn't waiting in line to think. It's delegating the math across the processor simultaneously while the graphics render separately.
That is brilliant.
It is. This allows the engine to resolve complex multi-theater military logistics, including simultaneous orbital mechanics and terrestrial geopolitics, in under 3 seconds during late game turns on massive maps.
Which perfectly synthesizes the core theme of this entire deep dive. I mean, whether we are talking about a C++23 engine elegantly distributing tasks for Civ 7, Insomniac offloading fluid dynamics for Venom, Kalshi's rigid algorithms failing to double-check a corrupt JSON payload, or JSEAL exploiting the convenience of our browser cookies.
The through line is that the systems governing our digital lives are only as resilient as their underlying architectures of trust. True technological progress requires human-in-the-loop governance.
Absolutely.
It requires authentic, verifiable user ownership, whether that means preserving your right to own a physical PlayStation disc or demanding that your digital identity is cryptographically bound to a physical hardware chip. If we continue to rely on fragile, centralized assumptions, our data, our money, and our virtual worlds just remain perpetually vulnerable.
You know, it leaves me with one final provocative thought to ponder based on everything we unpacked today. The UK courts just established a massive precedent by ruling that human theft of virtual goods is a real-world crime carrying a real-world prison sentence.
Yeah.
But as games like Civ 7th build increasingly complex, asynchronous, independent AI, what happens when an autonomous AI, acting on flawed telemetry like that Kalshi prediction glitch, commits the first multi-million-dollar virtual grand larceny entirely on its own? Who goes to jail then? The developer? The algorithm? Or the oracle that fed it the bad data?
That is the frontier we are rapidly approaching, and the legal system is nowhere near ready for it.
It's something to mull over as you log off and clear your cookies for the night. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the Tech and Night dossier. Stay curious, and we'll see you next time.